What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Rockcast, sponsored by Onyx Hunt Maps. And today we have Rockslide rider Jared Blumgren on. And yeah, this is going to be a great convo. Thanks for hopping on, man.
Hey, appreciate it. I always appreciate the invite to do something like this.
Yeah, we're great. We're super happy to have you on. It's been too long. Can you just start out by, you know, talking about, I think, you know, more so your hunting career, like how you like to hunt, where you like to hunt, how you kind of, because that goes into a ton of like choosing where you go is the type of style that you like to hunt and what kind of country you like to be in. So can you just like dive into that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you, I have to snicker a little bit when you say hunting career, because
I know,
I wish it was a career for me. You know, I wish I made oogles of money off of hunting, but we all know, most of us know that's not the way it is. No. You know, if I could put a price tag on the memories and the experiences that I gather while I'm hunting, I think I'd be the richest guy out there in some aspects. But you know, I cut my teeth on hunting, 35 years ago, even before that, you know, before I could even hunt, you know, with my family, I'd be out there watching my dad, watching my grandparents. And, you know, that's really what instilled the want to hunt in me. It's not because I need to do it by any means, but it's so much part of who I am, and it's part of who I came from in the past, and it continues to shape and mold me going forth. You know, I've been bow hunting now for 30, going on 33 years. I hate to even put a number on that. I start to realize how aged I'm getting these days. And, you know, it's a great thing looking back. It's a beautiful thing, actually, looking back and seeing all the experiences that I've gathered over the years. And, you know, I grew up in North Dakota and hunting very vast open country. You know, there's not a lot of trees up there. Many joke you can watch your dog run away for a week. And you know, I grew up in the Badlands, so that wasn't so much the case, but I'm very much into that open terrain type hunting, and that's something that I have a drive for to this day. But open terrain, you know, you're talking above the tree line, you get into that more open country. Granted, it's not flat by any means, but you stick me in the trees and I get a little anxious. I like being in the more open terrain, that type of hunting. And I love to go into the trees too. And I do hunting there, but I guess it's probably the way I was raised. I like that open style type of hunting, and that shapes what kind of hunts I do to this day. You know, whether it be elk, mule deer, whitetail, I always find myself in more of the broken open type country.
Nice.
And
Yeah. I'm exactly the same way. And it's really funny. Like, so yesterday I did a podcast with Howard on like tracking bucks and hunting timber bucks and how he likes that. That's his wheelhouse, is going in where it's tight. And a lot of that's just where he lives. It's really tight anyways. But he, you know, goes into, he just knows how to find them like that. And he walks around until he cuts tracks, and then he follows them until he gets into where the deer are. And he shot some big deer like that. But, you like the more open country, and you shot some really big animals just like that. So it's like, there's more than one way to skin a cat, if you will. Like, there's more than one way to do it. Yeah. And I think people should think about that too. If you're more comfortable in the timber, because maybe that's where you grew up, like maybe that's at least something to fall back on when you get discouraged or whatnot in the field.
Yeah, I think everybody has a strong point when it comes to looking back at how they grew up and the way they were taught and what they learned as they grew is really going to be their forte when it comes to the style of hunting that they prefer over others. And there's several out there. You can throw in any environment and they're going to be successful just because of the things they've learned over the years and the experiences that they gathered. But I would venture to say every one of those same individuals would also say what their favorite type of terrain is to hunt, what they're most successful in.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. So you're a busy guy and you don't exactly get to choose when you get to go hunting. I guess we could dive into that a little bit more, but what's the average time you think you get to spend on a hunt?
You know, if hunting was a career, it would be 365 days a year, right? Yeah. But, you know, holding down a full-time job, being in the National Guard and having that military obligation, raising three kids, making sure my wife is happy in everyday life. And, you know, it really takes a lot of time out of what I want to be doing, being out in the woods. Or, you know, my kids are getting to the age now where they're starting to hunt with me, which is a great asset. You know, I used to go from hunting up to 100 days a year. And, you know, since having kids, that's scaled way back to, I'd say, in today's day and age, I'm lucky if I get 40 to 50 days out there in the field. Mm-hmm. So I have to be very, very selective on the hunts that I choose. It's scaled me back to being more local type hunts, one or two states away, not doing some of the very large hunts that I used to do in the past. Although I would say I'm going to reach back or reach up to that point when the kids start getting older and they're starting to go with me more on some of these hunts too. So I really got to look at it, go to the drawing board and say, okay, I got this much time off from work. Which hunts are going to be realistic and which hunts aren't. I used to go from doing two or three out-of-state hunts a year. Now I'm lucky if I can do two out-of-state hunts a year just because of the limited time. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a game changer, but you just got to find the best way to adapt and overcome, I guess, and stack your cards in your favor.
Yep. Yeah. This year, about the only gap I'm going to have for any kind of a rifle season is going to be over Thanksgiving. And just so happens this year that lines up with Colorado fourth season. So hopefully we'll actually find out today if we drew fourth season elk, but not that is going to be my like first choice, but I want to go out in the field and hunt. And if that's the only time I have, like that's the way I kind of went about it this year, was instead of shifting the schedule to where the hunt would fit, it's kind of just choosing the hunt that was going to fit the schedule. So it's definitely a way to do it.
Yeah. Speaking of Colorado, that's a state that I haven't really tapped into a whole bunch. I've just been building points down there and kind of buying my time, but it's going to happen one of these years coming up soon.
Heck yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, they had a 75,000 applicant jump this year. So it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of years what happens in a lot of states.
Yeah, you know, you're going to see a huge demographic change of people out there trying to hunt. I have a feeling, you know.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch, I guess. So when you're planning these kind of hunts, and let's say an out-of-state hunt, just because I know like you're up in South Dakota and there's a lot of opportunity that's like right out the back door, which is nice. But what about like, you know, a couple states over or however, you know, you want to do it, you draw a tag there. What does your planning process look like?
So my go-to states has always been the Dakotas. I grew up in North Dakota. My roots are up there. So living in South Dakota now, it's not hard to get an archery tag in North Dakota. And, you know, it depends on what tag you can get. The whitetail is really easy to get. Getting an any deer tag is a little bit different story. This year I was lucky enough to draw an any deer tag in North Dakota. So that's a slam dunk, easy one to plan. You know, within 2 hours I'm up hunting in some of the ground that I grew up in. Stuff that I still know. So that's just a no-brainer. A couple of the other states, Montana and Wyoming, have always been my go-tos because I just, you know, being raised and growing up in those parts and those territories, I just kind of know the areas. So I can even slim down my hunting time, if you will, do shorter sessions to be able to be successful in those states. But the thing that starts going against me is I have to look at, okay, the draw odds for those two states. It's not what it used to be. You know, elk in Montana, even the deer used to be over the counter. So that was, you could literally just go hunt it whenever you wanted. Now with it going to more of the draw style hunt, if I want to hunt elk up there, so even with one or two points, it's going to take one or two points to draw a general tag. So I look at that, and then now I look at Wyoming. You know, I've had a couple limited entry hunts for elk in Wyoming, but that's, at that time, was 7-8 years apart. Now you're getting up to 10 years or better for limited entry. And so I started even with deer. So both elk and deer, I scaled that way back, and I basically have given up on hunting some limited entry stuff just because, you know, it'd be 60 before I probably be able to hunt some of those areas anymore. And so if I look at Wyoming, I look at Montana, and I adjust, I can almost hunt elk every year on limited, or excuse me, on general tags between Wyoming and Montana if I'm lucky enough to draw. One year I'm putting in for a preference point in one state, I'm hunting general in the other state. And then it just, if I'm lucky, it'll just switch back and forth between the two. And that's kind of been my focus lately. You know, it keeps me close to home. It keeps me close to the family until the kids are older and they start going with me more on some of these other hunts. I can start venturing out a little bit more. But unfortunately, I've been kind of shaped right now to where I have to pick. Either I hunt a high country mule deer one year or an elk one year. I just don't have the time to do both, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So that's the nature of the beast. That's what I have to do right now. But it's been very productive for me.
Yeah. Yep. I know it. I know it has, just looking. I know that when Robbie and Ryan did a podcast for me, like last October when I was in Alaska, and they filled in and talked about, like, every year we do a gear pick, you know, all the writers like put their top three picks in, they publish an article. They just went through that whole thing. You know, and they've always, in that article or in that podcast, they talked about, when they were talking about your gear picks, they're like, Jared does, like, for the amount of time it seems like he has to go, like, you definitely make the most out of every one of them, I think.
Yeah, I shouldn't maybe say this, but up until last year was the first year I did not feel a tag. So it kind of hurt. Wyoming elk hunt last year is focusing on a certain bull on general. And it was the first time I came home not feeling a tag, and it was a hard one to swallow, but after 32 years, I guess that's still probably pretty good odds.
Yeah, those are still pretty good odds. Why do you think that is? Like, what do you think separates, you know, you from the vast, vast majority of people who, you know, they might fill one tag in 32 years?
Time in the field, your research, knowing your equipment, knowing yourself. So there's a whole gamut of things that come in to make somebody successful. There's guys that go out there, including me, go out there sometimes and just get plain dumb lucky. And it's not the case every time, obviously, but, you know, I look at the time I spend, whether it's scouring maps, whether it's driving and putting boots on ground in the place I'm going to hunt, whether it's being out there in the spring looking for sheds, or just going there in the middle of summer and camping. I'd say the research is probably one of the biggest parts of it. And I've done several articles in the past about what is probably one of the most key aspects to a successful hunt. And I would have to say patience and persistence. You know, it's not going to always come easy for everybody, and it has certainly not come easy for me every time. But being persistent and patient, I think, has probably filled more tags for me than anything.
All right, everybody, I'm just jumping in the middle of this one. I would like to thank our sponsor, Onyx Hunt Maps, for powering the podcast and making this thing spin around. One of the things Jared is talking about right now is logistics and how important logistical planning is and getting in and out of your areas and things like that. Onyx is a huge tool for me in those things. And obviously while out hunting, you know, I can hop on and drop pins where I think there could be animals. And then I can modify those pins in the field and get them dialed in. One of the things that I use a ton is the trails. Obviously the hiking trails going from a trailhead into an area, and then I could bounce off the trail if I want. One of the cool features about the trails that it shows you is the grade of the trail. So if it's a really flat grade, it'll be a green trail. If it's, you know, it'll basically go from green to yellow to orange to red, depending on your steepness. Obviously red is really steep, and most of the time I don't love seeing that when it's coming up on the trail, but that's a super good tool to use. You can judge how long it might take you to get into an area. If you're going to have to climb a lot, obviously you can't go as fast, most people anyways. So that's a really cool tool from Onyx. We use it all the time, and just Onyx as a whole, we use it a ton. So if you haven't got an Onyx membership, or if you haven't messed with it yet, download the app and just check out the free stuff. You're not going to be able to access a lot of the things, but it'll give you a feel for it. And then if you decide that you want to go with it, go onto their website, onyxmaps.com/hunt. When you go to get your membership, type in the code ROCKCAST, ROKCAST, and you're going to get 20% off on us. So, awesome. Back to this episode.
That's interesting. Yeah. Getting your logistics down. I preach that quite a lot on here. Making sure your logistics are dialed, so when you roll into the area, there's no doubt about where you're going to park. You know, there's like, I'm going to park here, I'm going to walk up this ridge, these are my glassing points. Like, you have your logistics stuff dialed, and then stay out there. Like, it's interesting. I know I was just reading through an article that you wrote this morning, and one thing you talked about was the mentality you have to have out there. And I just cannot stress it enough to people. Like, especially if you're going to be by yourself, like 3 days in the backcountry is a freaking eternity.
You hit that on the head there. Yeah. Last year, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. And last year in Wyoming, up above timber hunting elk, and I was there a week by myself. And you're right. After just even a couple days of getting your butt kicked, it really wreaks havoc on you mentally. Not only are you physically tired at that point, but I think the mental aspect of it comes into play more than the physical after you're there for 2 or 3 days and just getting your ass handed to you each and every day. It being mentally tough is a huge part of it. And a lot of guys don't even think about that. Mm-hmm. I know you can't take somebody from the East who is a diehard whitetail guy, put them in elk country by themselves and expect it not to change them mentally. And it's just, it's a whole different thing when you're up there on the mountain by yourself and you really start to realize how insignificant you really are in this world when you're up there by yourself experiencing everything there is to offer.
Yeah. It seems like if I stay busy, I'm okay. But there's been times where, you know, I've like grinded to get back into a canyon or a basin or something, and I'll set up camp. And as soon as camp is set up and there's like kind of nothing else to do but wait for a few hours until it's really like good time to glass or something like that, that's where, especially like early on in the season, that's where my mind starts spinning. And I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah, you like to think that you're ready for anything when you're out there, and it's just not the case all the time. And it takes a humble person to realize you don't have everything you thought you had when you get up on the mountain, and it takes even more of a humble person to admit that to somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's important. I think everybody is going to go through it at least at some point. Before we keep diving, because I want to dive into the solo hunting and the pros and cons of that. And you've done a ton of that stuff. I want to reel back real quick and just ask you like what you're looking for, like for when you're scouting for like elk, let's say, for like a limited entry archery tag. What are the kinds of things that you look for when you go on a scouting trip?
So you know, thinking back to my last limited entry in Wyoming, it was a place I've never stepped foot. And I went over there on a camping trip and just took off hiking. Obviously, the elk aren't going to be where I was going to be scouting. They were way up high, up above the timber for the most part, in some of that really dark stuff right at the tip of the of some of the peaks. Is I know that's where the elk are in the summer. As low as I was, they just aren't in that area yet. So I was looking on, did a lot of walking on ridges, looking for bedding areas, looking for rubs from the previous year. Wallows are still easy to find, even though they're not getting hit at that time. It's still easy to tell which wallows were hot the year before. And I'll grid the whole area, marking what I think is good dark timber on ridges for bedding for elk. I'll look for those wallows. I'll look for large areas of several rubs in a certain area to know that the bulls are staging in that area. And food. What's the grass looking like in midsummer? If there's good grass, you know, in fall when season's here, the grass is still going to be there for those elk. But thing that you can't overlook is what's happening with cattle. Anymore, there's so much open grazing out in some of these mountain terrains that if your grass is good there when you're in midsummer, shoot, by the time elk season rolls around, those cattle might have that grass completely knocked out. So knowing what the grazing is going to be in the area is always a huge plus. And sometimes you just got to wing it at best because you just have no idea what those ranchers are doing with their cattle.
Mm-hmm.
I have found lately that it's become a lot more difficult to find areas where there's not cattle anymore. 10 years ago, never saw cattle in the area. Now, the open grazing and has really changed a lot of that. And then the same, you know, we're focusing on elk quite a bit, but then even with mule deer, when I go into the, in the middle of summer, if I go somewhere looking for mule deer, it's actually, in my opinion, easier to find mule deer in the summer than it is elk, because where those mule deer are in the summer is going to be typically where they're going to be in September when you're also going to try to archery hunt them. So getting up on the high peaks, watching avalanche shoots with good growth, has been very productive with me for mule deer.
Gotcha. So with those elk, I mean, obviously for that limited entry, that paid off big time. Could you talk a little bit about that limited entry and how, like, was it everything you thought it was going to be?
It was probably everything I thought it was going to be. It was one of those hunts that, you know, you go in there blind, but leading up to that hunt, I spend every weekend in there camping and hiking. So the wealth of knowledge that I gained in that alone, I bet I had 20 wallows marked on my GPS that I had found. And then you could easily tell certain areas that just had more elk activity than others. And I went in there, that season opened on September 15th. And I went in there, I came back from a Montana elk hunt, drove to Wyoming, got set up with camp on the 14th, hiked in a little ways. And that night, sitting in the tent, you know, I could hear some bugles. Over the next 2 days, I was in elk every day. Tried to kill one phenomenal bull that I just couldn't get an arrow at him. It just, everything was not working out the way it should have. I'd have him, I'd pull him to me and he would need to clear one opening and come into the clearing, and he'd turn around and go back to his cows. And I played cat and mouse with him for like that for 2 days. And he had a satellite bull with him that was no slouch either, just a great 6x6 pushing 350. And I passed that bull a couple different times. On the third day of the hunt, that big bull just, there was a lot of hunters in the area. The third day, that bull, he just disappeared. You know, I was finding a lot of the cows that I think he had with him, but that bull was nowhere to be seen. Talked with other hunters. They were after the same bull. It just, he disappeared. He's just a smart old bull. He went into his hidey hole, and I knew I only had two more days to hunt, and I set up and was able to slip in, find that satellite bull, which shouldn't be a satellite bull. And now was able to put an arrow in that bull, and he was pushing mid 340. So I was plumb happy. You know, it wasn't that 380 bull I was hoping for, but you can't pass a bull like that and on any hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So, it ended up going into it completely blind, but all the scouting leading up to it and going in there and killing a bull like that was a great experience and very successful hunt for me.
Paid off. That is awesome. That's awesome. So with that limited entry tag, do you see a big difference between the way those elk acted and then the general that you've been hunting?
You know, those limited entry tags, everybody wants them because I hear a lot of people say the elk are easier to hunt, and I guess I wouldn't say they're easier to hunt, but the numbers are better, so it is going to hold better bulls usually. The way the elk act, I would say limited entry, depending on the area, you know, you can get into some of these limited entry or just slammed full hunters, and those elk will act just like the elk will on some of those general units. And I have also found some elk on general ground that do not act like they're high pressure. It's all about finding the pockets, you know. Elk A over here doesn't know he's in the limited entry unit, and elk B over there doesn't know he's in the general. So I think their common way they act is all going to be the same. It just all comes down to the number of hunters in an area. I've seen them act the same in either type unit, I guess. If I could hunt a limited entry unit the rest of my life, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's more of a given, you know, in the number of elk are better. The quality is always better. It's just better opportunity. You know that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, go ahead.
But one thing, don't give up on these general units. I've killed my biggest bulls on general units too. Very, very high pressured units. So you can make it happen anywhere with the right homework.
And that was exactly where I was hoping that the question would go when I asked the question where I hoped it would go is just what you said, like, don't give up on the general units. I think that there could be some people waiting and just buying points, wanting to get into a certain unit instead of just trying to go hunt somewhere, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because they think it's going to be like, you know, just a scream fest of bulls, and it's not always that way. It's just, I think it kind of, depends on your tag strategy and if you're playing like a couple of different states, but just waiting, for like an 8-point unit and not having hunted elk before or something, I think that can be tough and a big letdown to people.
Absolutely. You got to ask yourself, how often do you want to hunt elk? Do you want to hunt elk once every 10 years, or do you want to hunt elk every other year or every 3 years? It's a no-brainer.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So let's see. I want to dive back into hunting and just kind of being out there. And I'm sure you get a ton of questions on solo hunting. And I do as well. Can you talk about that a little bit? And just, I'm not even sure which angle to go at it from, but just talk about solo hunting. And for somebody that, can't find a buddy to go with, or their buddy's backing out or something, what should they be thinking about if they're going to go solo?
There's so many rabbit holes we can go down, Jordan.
I know.
So I've done several solo hunts, and it's what I've always preferred to do is hunt solo, just because I seem to do better when I hunt solo, because it's just me taking my own actions into account and doing what I want to do. And I find that when I hunt with people, I always change how I hunt to accommodate how maybe they want to hunt or what they're capable of doing. Let's take into account, let's say it's a backcountry mule deer hunt and you're doing it solo. With any hunt, you're going to deal with a mental aspect of it. It's just you can be the toughest guy on the planet and think you're a hermit and you like to live alone, but you put yourself on the mountain and you spend several days on end by yourself. You got to have the mental toughness to do it. And it's new for me every time I go out there on the solo hunt. It's almost like I have to relearn myself and how to even try to explain that. But you find a different part of you, I think, every time you're on the mountain alone that you didn't maybe focus on before. What's your plan if you're solo? Not so much if you're mule deer hunting. Many people can pack out a mule deer by themselves. But if you're solo on an elk hunt, what's your plan to get that animal out if you get one? Is the weather going to be warm? And this goes for mule deer too. What's your plan, mule deer or elk? What's your plan if the weather's warm and you kill an animal? How are you going to take care of that meat? You know, for me, my spoils of the hunt are when I'm sitting at the table with my family and I'm eating that steak of the animal I worked hard to kill. I do not ever want to sit at my table and look up at the wall and see antlers without meat in the freezer. It's not what it's about in my mind. You got to have a plan for getting that meat taken care of. If it's an elk, you're definitely going to have a plan for how you're going to get out of that area. How many pack trips is it going to take you in and out? You want to look into calling somebody, a packer, to come in with horses to pack your animal out? Or are you going to handle it by yourself? I've known guys who have went in there, even just a pair, not just solo, even two guys, and they kill an elk. And now they're like, oh, crap, how do we get it out of here? And they've never had any experience of how to pack that meat, how to get it out of there in time. So you really got to think about what's your capabilities, where are you going to hunt? If you kill an animal, how are you going to get it out of there? And make sure you have all the tools you need to make sure it happens and it's successful for you. I'd hate to think about getting an animal on the ground and not having a plan to get it out of there.
Yep. But I think it happens. We were actually just having this conversation like last week or a couple weeks ago. And, you know, there was a few people around us and they all had stories of being like far on a horse, like far, far, and running into hunters that were back there for like a day trip with tiny little day backpacks. And just like, what are you guys thinking?
Oh yeah, it happens more than we want to admit, I'm afraid. And yeah. That, you know, that's a whole nother aspect now that you bring up horses, is if somebody's going in solo and they have access to horses, holy freaking cow, it is that's a game changer for you.
Oh yeah. You can just go and go and go and keep following the elk.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've never been able to go on a hunt with horses. I've never done it in my life. And it's always been something I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to own a pack horse just for that. And I've never had the opportunity. So maybe a little bit of jealousy going out there for you guys that own the horses. I'm envious of you. And I start to realize the older I get, the horses are probably going to have to become part of my arsenal before too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are really nice, I will say. On the meat packing and things like that, can you dive into that process of like a September bull, average September temperatures, I don't know, 65, you know, 60, 70 during the day. What does that process look like? To how do you hang your meat up? Like, what game bags do you like to use? And then how many trips do you plan on to get that thing out?
Yeah. So game bags is a huge part of it. I've been using Caribou game bags for, 10 years now or better. And no matter what game bag you use, is going to be a huge asset to keep the insects, the flies and everything off of that meat, right? You got to have them. Having a hunter's tarp to put down on the ground as you're taking care of that meat, to lay the meat down until you can get it hung, is always another great thing to have. When I get an animal on the ground, my first focus, get the pictures as quick as I can. You know, I'll take several hundred pictures sometimes, but I always have to remember the meat that's on the downside you have so much time before you have to get that meat taken care of before it starts to spoil.
Mm-hmm.
If my pictures are running long, I'll flip the animal over to the other side to make sure that side will cool too. And then as soon as I get that, the picture aspect of it done, I'm pulling out everything I have in my bag, my knives, and a huge asset is parachute cord. That 550 cord, some people call it, you know, especially with an elk, you can tie it to the leg, tie it to a tree and hold that leg up while you're starting to quarter that animal out. Getting the hide off as quick as possible, getting the quarters off, set them off to the side on the tarp, getting them in game bags. If you have citric acid to spray on, that'll help keep some of the flies off as well. It doesn't take no time really anymore to quarter out an animal mm-hmm. after doing it several times. And the fastest I can get it is more beneficial than anything. If you have a nice clean stream that's running pretty solid close by with cold water, anywhere in the mountains it's going to be cold enough water, you get that meat in the game bag and put it in that water for a little bit too to cool it down if you're close enough to do that. And then I'll use that same 550 cord, find a good tree, get it up, lift it up off the ground at least. I'd like to go 12 feet or more if I can. But looking for the shady spots, making sure it's not in the sun. A mule deer, I can pack out a whole mule deer by myself. My body's going to be screaming at me for the next several days afterwards. But even thinking about that, you know, with a whole mule deer in a pack, that meat's going to get pretty warm at times. You may have to stop depending on how far your hike out is to move some of that meat around to make sure it's cooling good enough. With an elk, if I'm solo by myself, it's going to take me 4 trips at least.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, everything that comes into play again now, here's your logistics. How far are you? Are you a half mile from the trail? Are you 2 miles? If you got horses, awesome. You might be 6 miles in. You know, it's just all of those logistics rolled up into shaping your hunt and how you're going to act once you get to that point.
Yep. So do you like taking the meat off the bone if you're going to hang it up? Like, you know, if you're going to make, like you're going to make a trip back to the vehicle and then you're going to come back. Do you like to have like everything deboned first and then hang it all up in game bags? Or do you ever just hang quarters up bone in and then debone it when you get back?
I've always hung my quarters up for elk bone in.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I'm going to hang it, I always leave the bone in and then I can pull it out later.
Nice.
There's been times I leave it hang and when I come back in, as I'm putting it in my pack while it's hanging, I can quick debone it right there while it's hanging. It makes it really easy. Meat just falls right off into my bag and you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Perfect. Anything else on that, the packing out thing or solo hunting that you have gotten questions about?
Yeah, a big one is what packs to use? What's the best pack out there? And by no means have I ever used the best packs out there. For the longest time, I grew up using a Cabela's Alaskan Guide 2 external frame pack.
Mm-hmm.
Got the work done. I've used Tenzing packs for years. It's got the work done. Are they the best packs? By no means. But one thing of advice is if you can afford to buy the higher end packs, definitely do it. You're going to thank yourself in the long run. And that has not been something I've done in the past, and which I should have. So you know, a good pack goes a long ways when it comes to comfort and getting animals out.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, you get that thing. It's just like anything else too. Like know your equipment and know how to use it. Right. And that I think is no different than backpacks. Like you can't just toss everything in and strap it on and load it up. Like take a little bit of consideration for, you know, the proper way to to pack a backpack. So it's like, it's carrying the load as comfortable and as like efficient as you can. Because if you just shove like all that meat down at the bottom of the bag and then all your soft goods or, you know, extra layers or whatever at the top, it's not going to be that comfortable. And you might be cussing you know, buying the nicer pack. But if you pack that thing right, it's gonna haul load a lot better.
Absolutely. You know, you talk about those guys that some people have seen with a day pack way back in there.
Yeah.
They're in for a rude awakening when they try to put 10 pounds of meat in that thing.
I know. Rude awakening. Yeah. Oh, man. That's funny. Well, I want to roll into some more gear stuff or tactics. I know a while back you wrote an article called, I think it was Building a Bow, like DIY style. And I want to dive into that and like a 10,000 foot overview of, all right, I just got this bow. You know, I used to be a good example of this because my closest archery shop was in Rapid, you know, and I was 2.5 hours, 3 hours from there, and to take my bow and get any kind of work done onto it. So I was a little bit forced to teach myself how to do some very basic things, but the basic things that I do know will get me out of a bind in the backcountry. So I just wanted to dive into that. And, you know, somebody who's a long ways away from an archery shop, or they want to get into it more on their own, what are some of the basic things that they need at home? And then how that, you know, can transfers to the field, and just some of the things that you do to make sure nothing's moved or things like that on your bow in the field.
You bet. Yeah. Huge overview. You know, I think back to when I was 10 years old and I started messing around with bows, and I started setting up my own bows at that time. And to think how I ever killed animals back then with some of the crap I did to my bows is beyond me. You know, my rest was not center shot. I had long 4-inch overdraws, and there was absolutely no center shot whatsoever. My arrow was kicked off to the left at least 1.5 inches, if not 2 inches. I used come alongs to get my bow to let tension off the string so I could put a peep sight in. And how the heck I have all 10 fingers and both eyes yet, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just like you, I taught myself how to do it for the longest time before I got the right tools. But in today's day and age, you just can't do the things we used to do with bows way back then. And, you know, for somebody wanting to learn, there's some very basic tools for doing it yourself at home. The number one thing that's probably one of the most important things, and it can be spendy, is having a good bow press. You know, you can do a lot of your bow setup without the bow press, but when it comes to putting a peep sight in, you absolutely have to have that. If it comes to tuning your bow and twisting your strings or changing your strings, you have to have good press. And I'm not talking I can't even remember what those presses used to be called, but they had the cable and a crank on them, which I used to use those a long time ago. Can't use those anymore on most of these split limb bows. And even if it's not a split limb bow, it's just the preload on those limbs anymore. It's just a dangerous thing. So absolutely look into buying a press. You have to have a press if you're going to start doing this stuff on your own. From there, a lot of the other stuff that you need is very basic. You know, some center shot tools to find where your center shot is, to tie in your knocking point or your D-loop. Some levels for figuring out where your arrow is level to set up your rest. And not quite as inexpensive, but something that has helped me a lot is like those Hamskia levels that are out there. You pay a little bit more for them, but you can do so much with them. You can use them to set your sight up the right way. You can figure out all your axes on your sight, and it's one tool that can do a lot of stuff, right? Figuring out how you're going to tie peep sights in, which material you're going to use to tie peep sights, D-loop material. There's a lot of different things that go into it, but like anything, the internet is a wealth of knowledge anymore, learning how to set up a bow by yourself. You know, that article I wrote for Rockslide a way back is one such article you can take a look at, and it'll get you on the right track to start doing your own DIY at home on your bows.
Yep. And absolutely.
To me, it's therapeutic to get a bow and set it up. I do it on the side as a job. I set up and tune bows for people just kind of as a side gig, just mostly for friends or family or people that know me. And it is, it's therapeutic. It's fun to do. Once you learn how to do it, you won't want anybody else to touch your bow anymore.
Yeah. Well, and you know, just knowing some of the basic things, like honestly, like even tying a D loop or serving in a peep sight, like, or tying in a peep sight, like it's really frustrating when something bad happens and you're basically out of luck until you, you know, get to a pro shop. And good Lord, that could be so far away if you're in the backcountry and just need to fix something simple. I've relied pretty heavily on the YouTube videos that Levi Morgan put out about how to do all that stuff, tying in and like where to start, you know, just where to start with everything once you get a new bow. And yeah, it's just, it doesn't really take much to just, you know, a few evenings, like sit down and watch some YouTube videos and practice it and just get an idea of how to fix some of that stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, now you're talking, so this was all when you're at home doing it yourself, you know, you have access to a bunch of different tools, a bunch of different avenues to do it. But now what if you're out there and on a hunt, and what do you need to have with you when you're on a hunt? And it really, it's basic stuff that I take with me. I have a Allen wrench set that goes with me everywhere, to make sure I can tighten up anything on my bow that's needed. Dental floss, you know, your peep sight's tied in with serving usually, or some other BCY material, but something as simple as dental floss, you can use to tie in again if you have to, if something comes loose. And obviously dental floss is multifaceted, different yep. things you can use it for. So having it is a no-brainer. Getting that piece of jerky out of your meat to tie it in your peep sight, to suturing up a wound if you have to. There's a lot of different things. You know, look for tools that you can use in different avenues. But having a Allen wrench set, some dental floss, because really, if your sights or rest comes loose, your Allen wrench set's going to take care of that. If your peep sight comes loose, your dental floss is going to tie it back in. Outside of that, if you nick a bowstring or break a bowstring, you're coming off the mountain anyway. Mm-hmm. So I always make sure I have a backup bow sitting back at the trailhead in my vehicle. So if something bad does happen, you know, I can go back and get that bow versus having to drive to a pro shop somewhere off the mountain and buy a new set of strings. Another thing that has been very beneficial over the years is, so you got your bow all set up, you're going to go out in this extravagant hunt. Well, most sites now, they have tick marks on all the adjustments on the site. So what I do is I take a pencil and I make marks on every part of my site that could move. So if that pencil mark moves or is away from the other part of the site, I know it has moved. Having all those marks on any movable part of my bow, I can always do a quick reference look at it, know if something has moved or know if my bow is still dead nuts. And that has been a huge asset. And every morning before my hunt, I'll look at my sights. I'll look at all those reference marks, make sure they're all in check, look at my rest, make sure they're all in check, do a quick inspection of the strings, make sure that everything is good to go there, make sure the peep is good. And I'll take a marker and even put a line on my string by my peep sight so I can tell if my peep sight ever moves. If any of those move, you have your Allen wrench set to put your sight or your rest back in the parameters it was where you made all your marks, and then you can look at your peep. If your peep moved, which it shouldn't unless you lose your tie off, and if you did that, you have your dental floss, or if you take a little BCY material with you, you can tie that back off too. But I think just a couple of really easy things like that, and it goes a long ways.
Yeah, super smart. Super smart thing to do. Do you try to shoot like at least once a day when you're out in the field? Do you do anything like that, or do you just keep an eye on what you've marked?
Before I leave the trailhead, I'll have my target there, and I'll always shoot before I take off to make sure everything is good. After that, I won't shoot unless there's a bluegrass that's really pissing me off, or if I'm shooting at an animal, I guess. Because today's day and age, with the power of bows, you can't barely shoot anything without blowing an arrow up. So I just kind of leave it to God at that point and hope everything stays on. If all my marks on my sight rest are good and my peep sight hasn't moved, everything should be in check.
Yep. Awesome. Awesome. Well, we're coming up on an hour. Is there anything else that you wanted to dive heavily into?
No, not at this time. You know, there's, like I said, all kinds of rabbit holes, and we can go down many more on another call sometime in the future. But right now, you know, there's not anything glaring that pops out at me. As always, if something does come up, if there's a question, somebody wants to hit us up on Rockside on the thread that's posted there, by all means do so. And myself or Jordan can answer to the best of our ability.
Awesome. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. People, I will link to, man, all the articles that we've talked about, I'll link to them down in the show notes. And I guess one last thing on communication wise in the backcountry, when you're soloed, are you still rocking an inReach?
You know what? I have never rocked one.
Oh man.
And I need to. That is probably one of my biggest shortfalls, is I have always said I'm going to buy one. And every time I'm out there and I don't have one, I'm kicking myself in the ass for not doing so, because you need it. You just absolutely have to have it. Luckily, this last year where I was elk hunting, when I was up high on the mountain, I had service. But anytime I dropped low to get into the elk, I was out of service.
Yeah.
And that is a huge game changer. I highly recommend. And how can somebody who doesn't use one themselves highly recommend it? It's because I know I need one. But yeah, an inReach is definitely on my next purchase.
On the list. Yeah, man, they're pretty dang nice. But even, you know, you not having one, I think some of it is nice that you've been in service, but do you do some kind of a contingency plan with your wife or somebody else that, like, hey, if you haven't heard from me by this, this, and this, like, this is where to go?
I do. I always reach out to my two brothers and my wife, and I tell them, okay, this is exactly where I'm going to set up camp. This is where I'm going to be hunting. This is the basin where I know there's going to be bucks. I'm going to be hunting in that basin. This is where I think the elk are. I know I'm going to be in this area. And I always try to reach back at least every 3 days, whether it's hiking to the tall peaks to get some service or hiking back down to the trailhead and driving out to get service. I always make sure if they know if they don't hear from me by day four, something, either I got an animal on the ground I'm trying to take care of, or something's wrong. Mm-hmm. So I let them use their best judgment at that point, what they need to do. But luckily, knock on wood, up to this point, I haven't had any issues, but I've definitely been in some of those circumstances where I thought, this is so stupid, I don't have a plan. And an inReach, I should slap myself upside the head for not already having one. And I'll have one by next season. I promise that.
Yeah. Yep. They're nice just to be able to shoot off a message, or, you know, just keep people updated, and then not have to like hike to the top of a ridge late at night to get service either.
See, now you're talking like a smart person, and here I am just the dummy who hasn't bought one yet.
Well, yeah, I don't know about that. Oh man. But awesome. So thanks again for hopping on. I will, I'll link to everything down in the show notes, and people can get a hold of you if they want to or need to. And, it was a great talk.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jordan, for the opportunity. And it's always good talking to you and everybody else out there listening. You have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out, and happy shooting.
Perfect.